Namaste and welcome to the Bharatvarta Weekly. I have with me Prasanna Vishwanathan, CEO of Swaraja Magazine, and also our favorite guest, Nirav Kanodra, here with me.
Hi, Roshan. Hi, Prasanna.
Yeah. Hi, guys.
And together we'll be taking you through the news and events of the week that was. It was quite a busy week, I must say. Plenty of news from geopolitics. We had Minister S. Jaishankar visiting Israel, and there is, you know, plenty of talk around a trade agreement being signed with Israel. Then we had Prime Minister Modi visiting Italy for the G20 summit. And then, of course, we had the tragic death of actor Puneet Rajkumar. And in other, you know, film news, we had Shah Rukh Khan's son Aryan Khan out on bail. Then a bunch of corporate stuff as well. So we had all the big tech earnings call, and then of course Facebook rebranding itself to Meta, closer home, the IRCTC convenience fee fiasco, which caused the stock to, you know, go topsy-turvy. So plenty to talk about. Let's get started. Prime Minister Modi is visiting Italy on account of the G20 summit. This is the first in-person summit since the coronavirus pandemic. Climate change, COVID-19 economic recovery, and the global minimum corporate tax rate are important topics on the agenda. Prime Minister Modi will be the first Indian Prime Minister to attend the summit in almost 12 years. He also had a very warm meeting with the Pope, Pope Francis, inviting him to visit India after discussing a wide range of issues with him. Nirav, this is a pretty interesting visit, right? I mean, what is the larger significance of this?
Well, so I think India has been a member of G20 for a while. Earlier, all the last year and a half, so we've had all these meetings, or even the small working groups have been virtual. So it's a good thing that, you know, we are going past the pandemic and meeting in person. Also, India is looking to get more trade deals done with all these developed nations. So separate one with UK is being on the cards, separate one with EU, one with like Israel and like the Saudi and UAE together. All these things are there. So it helps that you're in person. I think the agenda of the G20, there are three broad pillars. So one is a global corporate minimum tax that has to be agreed upon. I think there is a lot of consensus on that. On climate change, I think India is leading a voice for developing nations, saying that some of the climate change goals or restrictions are unfair on emerging or developing countries. So there is some sort of friction. We may not see like a big agreement. And lastly, it is still on healthcare and coronavirus and global vaccine supplies. Again, now India has a big role. India is one of the largest manufacturers of vaccines. And unlike, say, like Pfizer and Moderna, who are not willing to share their technology, they will only manufacture in the US and export. I think India has large capacity, can export vaccines to the global south. So these are the three main topics. It's a good opportunity for Indian leaders to go. So the Prime Minister Modi to go and meet all the leaders, as well as the smaller working groups meet as well. And probably it's a good sign for signing future FTAs. So hopefully the results come out favoring India, but otherwise it's just another annual G20 meeting.
What do you make of the meeting with Pope Francis, Prasanna?
I think more like a goodwill gesture. Of course, there is always this undercurrent of what I would call as a contestation of ideas between the church and, you know, the larger dharmic religious framework in India. You know, there is also a need for, according to me, a slightly differentiated strategy, in the sense that, you know, that sometimes all of us are habit of looking at the entire Christian religion in a very homogeneous way. So if you typically look at the Catholic faith per se, especially the way it operates in India, they are not as much into, let's say, predatory proselytization, and also they also have a long history of serving in education and healthcare. But of course, they do have a very strong presence in policy making, media, academia, and all. And sometimes, you know, the religious agenda and the governance agenda do have a conflict. It's very critical that we need to differentiate between evolved, theologically sophisticated strand of Christianity like Catholicism from, you know, the predatory proselytization, which are typically led more by the evangelical churches, and you know, that's the kind of approach that I think it might suit India also well, in the sense we are a secular nation. I mean, though largely dharmic, I don't think so. There is any, unlike say what happens in the Islamic nations. There is no active antagonism against any other faith or religion. So to that extent, you know, and also let's not forget that Pope is also a head of the state. He's just not a theological figure. So I'm not reading too much into the meeting, except that, you know, it's very good diplomatically to have this dialogue.
No, I think it's a formal state visit, right? Mm. So this is on the cards. I mean, you cannot let any kind of personal idiosyncrasies get in the way. Aryan Khan walked out of the Arthur Road prison after spending more than 3 weeks in jail. Following his arrest during a drug raid on a cruise ship off the city coast, Khan was released on a bail of rupees 1 lakh with 14 conditions that he has to follow. These include not making statements regarding the current investigation, not leaving the country, not tampering evidence or influencing witnesses, and more. Prasanna, I mean, this has been a saga for about 3 weeks. And, you know, we have kind of kept away from covering some of this stuff because, you know, we thought it'll pass, right? But, you know, what do you make of this entire thing?
In any society, okay, leave alone India, like even in the West, whenever there is a celebrity or a, you know, a son of a celebrity or somebody closely related to the celebrity involved in a, you know, drug use or alleged drug use and all that, there will be heightened media coverage and there will be a lot of, you know, gloating, quote unquote, because, you know, see, there is always this underlying feeling, more so in a country like India, that the rule of law is very selective. And let me tell you that, you know, I think just because he was a celebrity, he was probably able to marshal all the best, you know, legal support from Rohtagi onwards, who doesn't come cheap for sure. And they kind of mobilized all legal support and managed to get him out on bail on 3 weeks. But typically, you know, in colloquial legal parlance and also in drug cases are usually called the ganja case. And it's, the laws are so draconian that generally drug cases, the usually bail is an exception, not the norm. Which is not the case with so many other laws in the country, okay? And people just are incarcerated in jails for years together on drug cases. What really was quite troubling is how one, of course, I mean, I wouldn't really, because of celebrities involved, I think naturally this kind of media blitz and coverage is something very natural. I mean, I would not like to be like too moralistic and say, you know, this is media. Beyond the point, even in terms of the narrative, we as a society, something that we need to introspect is how we selectively bring in these issues of identity to, you know, demonize or support someone. You know, one hand you have Shahrukh's son, Aryan Khan himself is a product of a mixed faith. You know, Shahrukh might be a Muslim, his mom is a Hindu. It was kind of converted into some kind of, you know, they bought in this identity element, starting from, you know, edits in various papers, subtle insinuations that, you know, it's a kind of a communal, you know, undertone which is driving this entire witch hunt against Aryan Khan. But on the other hand, the prosecuting officer from the administration, Samir Vankade, he also is a person, you know, who comes from a mixed religious heritage. But, you know, that gets hardly highlighted. In fact, they kind of made it as a person who's misused reservation to get into the administration. So it was pretty much a no-holds-barred kind of, you know, very nasty campaign unleashed. I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. Probably it had the direct patronage of Shahrukh or his ecosystem. But certainly, you know, there seemed to be a very subtle, coordinated messaging for the last 3 weeks, which was quite disappointing, because ultimately you have to get the rule of the law and, you know, all of the police investigation to go without, you know, they being subject to all these kind of scrutiny. And the way some of the Maharashtra ministers, especially Nawab Malik, whose son-in-law himself was busted in a drug case, I think he took it on himself to make it a, you know, personal crusade against the investigating officer. Slightly disappointing that in the country, you know, we kind of reduce serious issues to crude identity politics without letting the police officers investigate. And in this case, you know, the police officer himself is quote unquote a product of India's syncretic culture, so as to speak, you know. I think anyway that he's got the bail and probably the media will move on to, they moved on to Shami, so which probably we'll discuss it later. But right. I personally think that, I mean, also this pushing this agenda about legalizing drugs and all that stuff, we're not that kind of either at that stage of economic prosperity liberty or the Scandinavian libertarian ethos that, you know, we could even consider discussing this issue, because I think we need serious law enforcement against drug usage at all levels, from people who produce, people who sell, people who peddle, people who consume. India is at the stage where, you know, state needs to be very, very brutal and ruthless. Of course, you can look at things like rehabilitation, and there should be a humane element as well in the system. But just, you know, I don't know whether it's fringe wise. I didn't see so many people even arguing that to legalize the use of drugs and all that stuff. So total spectacle, you know, that we could reduce any issue to. That's what happened in the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, I think there's been a call to reform NDPS and so on. Right. And pretty interesting. All right, moving on. The Indian External Affairs Minister, Minister S. Jaishankar, has made a trip to Israel to strengthen our Middle East ties. The first meeting of the foreign ministers of India, Israel, the US, and the United Arab Emirates decided to establish an international forum for economic cooperation and discussed joint infrastructure projects in transportation and technology. The meeting, described in some quarters as the new Quad, also focused on ways to expand economic and political cooperation in the Middle East and Asia and to enhance maritime security. Nirav, again, what is the larger significance of all of this? We're seeing like so many of these new, potentially new orders and allies and alliances form in geopolitics. Right? So what is really happening?
So I think, see, first, what is happening is you had, this is one of like the Trump administration's win, which was, you had a peace accord between Israel, UAE, and Saudi. And now you're having an Indo-Abrahamic alliance, which is India, UAE, Saudi, and Israel. It connects the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean, right? And then it's an access path to Europe. With Jaishankar going and meeting, is a meeting of foreign ministers. But what is under in the pipeline, by June 2022, they want to sign an FTA, a free trade agreement between India and Israel. I think that would be a fantastic thing. There are a lot of complementary skill sets. So one is, for example, India is building a lot of like metros and high-speed rail, etc., with some help from Japan. But like India is investing in infra. I think Israel is also trying to connect itself. It's a very small country, but add more. So I think that is where India can export, as well as your other manufactured goods. Whereas Israel has a lot of ability in water conservation, agricultural technology, and that India needs to leverage from. So I think this FTA is a fantastic thing once it happens. Second thing is, you are building, like, a lot of these things are actually, in a way, it's been in response to China. So China has its own One Belt, One Road strategy. So India has this kind of a trade route connecting India to Europe. So this is another trade route which goes through. So that's a fantastic thing. India is trying to get its house in order. See, we are like 20 years behind China in these things. But these are all steps. It's like what China joined WTO in 2000, 2001, where India is building alliances. India has a lot of PLI schemes for manufacturing locally. There's a big push to build infra locally, which can actually facilitate global trade. So you can move out goods faster or move in raw materials faster. So these are all like building blocks. And these building blocks are being built one by one by one. So this is one critical element. It's a fantastic thing. Israel has been a long-standing ally of India. A lot of defense-related trade happens between India and Israel. So as a geopolitical ally, it is like Quad is on east of India, right? Australia, Japan, and the US. It's more at the Pacific. This is from Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean, right? So I think this is a good thing, very beneficial. Hopefully all these talks go well and Indian exports get a big boost out of this.
Closer home, in some very tragic news, the Kannada actor Puneet Rajkumar passed away due to a cardiac arrest. He was 46. The actor was found collapsed while working out in a gym and was rushed to Vikram Hospital to receive immediate treatment in the ICU. And despite the doctor's best efforts, the actor remained non-responsive. He was declared dead at 2:30 p.m. The city of Bangalore was placed on high alert as news of the star's passing spread. Ample police battalions were deployed by the state government in anticipation of a furor. According to a few reports, Puneet Rajkumar's body shall later be taken to the Kanti Rava Stadium so as to allow fans to catch a glimpse, to catch a final glimpse and pay their respects. I think this was probably yesterday. Well, I mean, this is very, very tragic. I mean, anytime someone relatively young dies, right, I mean, it really calls for introspection, you know. It reminds you again that life is very fragile and fleeting. So Puneet Rajkumar, you know, I mean, having grown up in Bangalore, I can say that, you know, I've seen his career, although I was not a very big fan. I've seen his career and I've seen him grow up, right? I think literally everyone watched him grow up. He started as a child actor. Got the national award for a movie called Better the Hoo-Woo. I think his first proper film as a hero came out in 2002.
Yeah.
And I lived about, you know, hardly a kilometer away from Adarsha Theatre at that time. So it was a big deal for us. His first movie was Appu. And, you know, aside from being a pretty popular Kannada actor, and he starred in a bunch of, you know, multiple Kannada movies, right? I mean, his last film came out very recently, Yuvaratna. He was also someone who was a very charitable person, you know, ran multiple orphanages, goshalas, has sponsored education of many children and so on. And there is literally not a single person who has come into contact with him who doesn't share a good memory of him, right? Very, very humble, not in the least arrogant, right? Very, very contrasting to, you know, some of the other film stars we might see, right? So yeah, I mean, this is extremely tragic. And can I say, I mean, I guess all of us should take care of our health and probably get a health checkup often enough, you know.
And also, I think when you come from the family of Dr. Rajkumar,
yeah,
cultural icon and probably without unquestionably the greatest actor Kannada movie industry has ever produced, I think it's very tough for any person to fit into that kind of issues. Having said that, I think though his Shiv Rajkumar might be probably a larger than life hero and probably has had more commercially successful movies, I think Puneet was certainly a much more versatile actor in my book. And also, you know, he kind of inherited his father's gene in terms of the musical inclinations as well. You know, Rajkumar was a trained singer and he was also strongly rooted in the Dharmic traditions. In fact, Rajkumar's early rooting was in performing Puranas and other Kannada Hindu cultural related performances, actually. So, you know, very tragic, like you say, life gone too young. And only thing that I fear is that there is a lot of unverified speculation about, like, you know, exercise, dangers of exercising, going. I think especially in Bangalore, I see like lots of WhatsApp. Hopefully a kind of sense of balance in terms of how we discuss this issue is restored. You have a lot of fake forwards from doctors and all that stuff. So slightly, I think every tragedy you have this kind of reactions. Hopefully people can differentiate good advice from bad advice and, you know, do what is good for their health and take care of themselves. So that's the key takeaway here.
No, I think there were more than a couple of WhatsApp forwards from Dr. Devi Shetty. I mean, of course, he has come out and clarified that, you know, it is fake, right? All right. Moving on. The shares of IRCTC took a hit almost as much as 30% and made it back last week. And the reason was because of the convenience fee that was going to be levied on ticket bookings. The Ministry of Railways used to decide the quantum of charge levied before it was scrapped in 2016. However, the reintroduction of the fee in 2019, with the reintroduction of the fee in 2019, the Railways Ministry asked IRCTC to share 50% of revenues it generated from the convenience fees for bookings made on the website. Prasanna, I mean, we've seen back and forth on this, right? And I think plenty of people put out very good Twitter threads also on explaining, you know, why this is a dumb idea, right? But thankfully, you know, I think better sense has prevailed. What do you make of all of this?
See, I think the bad and the good, there are two aspects to it. Okay, the bad is still, you know, the bureaucratic mindset. Maybe the railway establishment has this legacy of bureaucratic overreach where, you know, you don't look at the long-term value creation and you do a very knee-jerk kind of administrative action that wiped out so much minority investor wealth, actually. But the good thing is that we saw immediately the finance ministry, especially the DIPA, which is now spearheading all the disinvestment initiatives, they quickly came in and, after which the knee-jerk move to demand 50% revenue share was revoked. And also, in light of the very ambitious, aggressive disinvestment agenda that DIPAM is pursuing, and also it was good to see the DIPAM secretary categorically asserting that the minority shareholder interest needs to be protected, actually. And I think the instead of asking this kind of a revenue share, if you know, you're allowing IRCTC, which is doing phenomenally well, except for the recent setback, still, you know, from the listing price to what it is quoting today in the markets, despite the 30% decline recently, it's still quite a huge value creation. So if they really want the money, they could have taken it as a dividend instead of, you know, the revenue share that they are looking at. IRCTC is a, like it or not, you know, I think large part of the value is because of the fact that it's a technology monopoly, provides both, from ticketing and catering perspective, it has a complete monopoly as things stands now currently. Of course, I would think that in the next 2-3 years, there will be competition in through the private trains, which got delayed partly due to pandemic and partly, you know, also the way in which the entire, the privatization process was handled. So, but I would assume that, I mean, and I'm pretty certain that, you know, this is an initiative that will again regain steam, and then and once you allow the private players, you also need an independent rail regulator, because without an independent rail regulator, the private players will be very reluctant, especially with this kind of, you know, legacy bureaucracy can wreak havoc. So I think DPAM signaling has been good, but this could have been completely an avoidable fiasco. And especially, you know, they also went in. Nirav can add on. I'm just closing, and I think they had a share split also, stock split just before that, so that to attract more widespread retail participation. At least that's the intended, behind the move.
Yeah.
So overall, you know, avoidable fiasco, but I would say partially retrieved by DPAM signaling. That's my sense of this issue.
Yeah. Actually, just adding, the whole lesson from the whole fiasco, right, is traditionally all these PSU firms were treated more as like a welfare scheme. So you generate employment, give out handouts, as well as a piggy bank that, okay, because these are monopolies, you can take money out as you want, when you want, right? And now that you're listing it as a public stock market, it's a very good thing that this shows you that the market is giving you a signal that probably this is not the right decision. And as we transition more towards a markets-oriented economy, it is telling you very quickly, it's instant feedback that the market didn't like it, then what are the reasons, you can go through it. And given India wants to disinvest a lot more, Air India has been done, but we want to disinvest a lot more, these kind of things would make PSU shares trade at a discount, because you say that there could be bad decision making. It's a very good thing that people have taken feedback and they have kind of reversed the decision. So it is the quickest form of you getting instant feedback that you don't make too many bad decisions. So hopefully it's a good sign. So I'm looking at it as glass half full, not glass half empty, that a bad decision was reversed quite quickly.
Oh, that's a great point. That's a great point. The fact that, you know, there was quick feedback, right? And that feedback was taken. But Nirav, I mean, there's also a case to be made that the retail investor share can be increased, right? I mean, if you look at how things have, you know, I mean, people have pumped and dumped the stock over the last 6-7 months, right? I mean, they keep seesawing the stock and making gains on momentum and stuff. So what do you make of that?
Well, so I think one is the share split is a good thing, increases like the lot size falls. So like maybe more retail participation. I think if after this, the stock recovers a lot, maybe the government can slowly divest by selling to like secondary offerings to retail shareholders. So I think that's a very good thing. Basically, as long as I think there will be volatility, people who invest probably need to learn to live with it. If there is like actual market manipulation or collusion, where there are pump and dump schemes going on with all these WhatsApp or Telegram forwards, I think those need to be acted upon by SEBI saying that this is market manipulation, right?
Correct.
That you don't want kind of a Harshad Mehta, Ketan Parekh type scam. But if not, I think volatility is a part of it. And stock market collectively gives you the market signal back. So if there is a valid signal, yes, the company can act on it. If it is pure noise or if it is manipulation, then the regulators need to act on it.
Right. Absolutely. And finally, Facebook changed its name to Meta in a rebranding exercise. The new name will signify the company's attempts to create a metaverse, a digital construct that brings together the virtual and real worlds. The name of the platforms that it controls will be the same, with only the name of the parent company changing. However, shares of big US tech companies, big tech companies, struggled with the losses in Alphabet, Amazon, and Microsoft. Amazon shares dropped more than 4% in extended trading on Thursday after the company reported weaker than expected results for the third quarter and delivered disappointing guidance for the critical holiday period. After the earnings call, Microsoft surpassed Apple's market cap on Friday to become the world's most valuable public company. The change follows Apple's Thursday's earning call, where the company posted strong results but revealed that it lost $6 billion to supply chain constraints. Well, I mean, we've seen, you know, what has happened over the last year or so, right? I mean, with all this quantitative easing and, you know, plenty of dry powder available in the market, I think market caps have gone up, you know, significantly for what are fundamentally the same companies, right? And I think we will see some sort of a correction sideways, maybe in a bunch of these is only expected, right? But, you know, Nirav and Prasanna, do you think this is the early signs of that?
I think Microsoft had stellar results. Okay. Especially their cloud computing business, LinkedIn, all their software as service offerings. I think phenomenal results for Microsoft, which is why probably it kind of became the most valuable company again with almost 2.7 trillion market cap. Even Alphabet results were good. The two disappointments were Amazon and Apple. Amazon was very interesting in the sense that I think this was long time coming. They always had a problem with their employer brand, right? Like it was subject to a lot of scrutiny, especially the working conditions and all. And suddenly, I think last year was very good for them. They just gained because the physical and the main street businesses suffered because of closures, and also almost all the online retail shopping gains were captured by players like Amazon. But unfortunately, I think they've been having a huge struggle in hiring people. So almost the profitability, I mean, in fact, the concern that they have expressed is that the next quarter, they even hinted that almost all their profitability will wipe away because of the wage increases that they need to give for the employees. And they are actually paying huge hiring premiums, sign-up bonuses. They have expanded, of course, their warehouse and fulfillment centers. And also they need to be staffed. And because, as I said, they have this slightly dubious employment brand, you know, they're finding it very difficult to attract people, and so they are paying huge premiums over and above, you know. I think they already increased the minimum wages. So I think the labor cost in a tight labor market is really hitting Amazon badly. Apple, I think, is a more predictable in the sense it's essentially the shortage of semiconductors. And of course, I think iPhone 13 production was hit because you had a huge COVID upsurge in Vietnam, of all places, where I think some of the key components of iPhone 13 are assembled. And then also floods affected some of the Foxconn factories where they were producing it. So the supply chain troubles and semiconductor shortage predictably dampened their sales and doesn't look good for the next quarter also. So I'm, as I'm sure you would have discussed this issue before, I don't think so additional fab capacity is something that can be you know, generated overnight, you know, though TSMC, Intel putting huge monies partly driven by government subsidies to set up fab capacity. I think all those will go online in another 12 to 18 months. So semiconductor shortage is going to be real. I think Apple's maybe the next year would also be a challenge. Maybe at least half of next year would be a challenge. But good news for Microsoft, though, you know, stellar performance. And I think Nadella deserves a lot of credit for the focus and consistently delivering the results. You know, the last decade has been pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
For the company.
Yeah, for sure. I think the way cloud has happened, right, over the last year and a half, especially, I think Gartner has revised its estimates for IT spending, you know, mid-year, right? And they've added, I don't know what it is, $50 to $100 billion extra. So,
yeah. Even Amazon, I think almost their cloud business is so profitable compared to their online retail. Yeah. So it's pretty much, you could say it's cross-subsidizing it now. I found it quite interesting that Microsoft is making some inroads into the cloud computing business, where, you know, Amazon always had a, you know, a head start as well as was consolidating on the lead. I think this pandemic induced disruption, some of it might be permanent and structural in nature, which could still drive cloud business, I guess.
Yeah. No, it's also the headroom, right? I mean, if you look at any company right now, the IT spend on cloud will still be perhaps less than 5 or 10% of correct. Their total IT spend.
Correct.
So there's just so much of headroom to play. Headroom. And that's what we've seen, you know, even in terms of valuations of some of these cloud companies as well, right? But I want to talk about Facebook. You know, I think among all of the big tech, I mean, this is one company that still seems to be founder-led, right? And, you know, who could have really imagined that it will pan out this way, right? I mean, it's a 17-year-old company, you know, really. I mean, and since listing in 2012, I think their stock price has gone up 10 times, probably listed at around $35-$38, I think, right? And this, I think this is a very bold move in some sense, this whole meta or metaverse, as people are calling it, right? And I think, you know, some of these things look ridiculous until they become, you know, reality, right? And, you know, I mean, virtual reality and augmented reality has been the next big thing for, I think, years and years, for decades almost, right? And with some of the innovation happening on the Oculus front, I think this is, again, a very, very bold move to sort of signal that, you know, this is the next level of, you know, growth, right? And I mean, it used to always like drive me nuts how people would spend on Farmville and stuff like that, right? I mean, for virtual farms and for virtual pineapples and whatnot, right? But I mean, that's a reality, you know. And I think if there's some kind of a truly virtual universe, right? Given, you know, how people are spending on NFTs and so on and so forth, I mean, we might see a very different world, you know, in due time, I think.
Absolutely.
What do you think, Nirav?
We could have this podcast with our digital avatars talking to each other in a metaverse, right? And yeah, I think So Facebook, one of the other problems has been that now it's a 17-year-old company. People who are young adults like 17 years ago were the dominant early users and continue using Facebook. But the younger generation probably is not interested as much in Facebook, right?
Mm.
And so it is kind of like dropping off users. There has been a lot of issues with people either migrating to other social media platforms like Instagram, which Facebook owns, but like either like Twitter or Snapchat, etc., right? So this is what they're doing. They're betting big on this whole metaverse. They've also chosen, I think AR and VR seem to be like the old failed tech platform, like tech strategies, and like people were supposed to be, everything was supposed to be in VR. It didn't really take off. So now maybe this is a new stab at it. And it's a very bold move. And for all you know, with more work from home, probably everybody who's working from home could be working in a metaverse, and you may never see the person in reality. Maybe you just see their digital avatar. So who knows? It's just going to be interesting. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I think also they have been facing tremendous regulatory, pressure as well. And unfortunately, last 1-2 months with all those whistleblowers, and there is also this threat of further whistleblowing also happening. You know, there seems a nice ecosystem of whistleblowers emerging, which itself is an industry with well-funded industry with media operations targeting Facebook. So I think he needed a very compelling story and a vision. And like Nirav said, you know, they do have certainly a problem with younger demographics, and you know, also Instagram, the vulnerability of kids who are using Instagram is getting highlighted repeatedly, even by the lawmakers as well as by civil society as well, actually. So the entire social media part, I think Facebook pretty much doesn't cater to the younger demographics, though, you know, the statistics about the users are pretty phenomenal. Like more than half the world is Facebook user community. But I think like the usage, the time on the app and all must have come down dramatically. So this is a new company vision, you know, like for somebody like me who is not like completely into the techno world. It sounds like almost a techno utopia where, you know, he's creating a parallel universe. Actually, it is basically an invitation for people to inhabit a parallel universe. There is a parallel digital economy. There is a parallel digital, way of working, digital enterprises. Potentially, if they pull off the idea, I think it's like a complete new layer of GDP, economic activity that's created in the virtual world. So, audacious vision. Seems like there is also, it's just not a vision. He's almost promised 10 billion investment in the next 2-3 years, which is, and they've carved out their social media business separately. And like, you know, much like all these companies, even Amazon did when it started its cloud business versus the e-commerce. I think it's good thing that he's carved it out as a separate business. So you really know whether it's the investment is really going or it's just an audacious vision that he's presented without backing it with money. But the kind of money and done that is good. But Roshan, I might want to ask, because you might know better on this. Is like the VR and augmented has any adoption in a very significant way beyond like, say, the gaming community or say among the young people? I've really not, even that previous acquisition that you referred to, right, of Facebook. I don't think so. It's panned out the way they had originally hoped for. So what do you think will be the trigger point for like, say, a massive adoption of VR, AR?
No, I think unfortunately, this is one domain where hype killed a lot of the actual innovation, right? I think there was way too much promised. And, you know, you can think of cases like Magic Leap, for example, which raised, I think, $500 million. And probably didn't even put out a prototype, workable prototype out in the market, right? And things to that effect. I've worked in tech. I mean, VR has been the next big thing, right? And it's been the next big thing for forever, right? Almost more than a decade, I would say, right? So, but there are some very real uses on, Oculus. Like I know someone who's building something on Oculus for physiotherapy, for instance, and has shown like tremendous gains for patients, right? There are some very real uses as well. We'll really have to wait and watch, I think some of the business use cases have to really take off for mass adoption. That's what I feel, right? Because gaming will be again like a corner case in this entire thing, right? Because VR is such a fundamental disruption that I think, the day we start seeing it in hospitals, the day we start seeing it in schools and colleges, that is when, it will become truly mainstream, right? But, something that boggles my mind is how these guys are going against the classic innovators dilemma. You can probably argue that, IBM sold mainframes for longer than they had to, right? But obviously, they're sitting on a pile of cash and, what is the need to do something drastically different? But this guy is just, is going against that, right? And if you think about it, he was just a college kid who kind of inadvertently built the most powerful platform on the planet, right? Correct. And he's been at it for 17 years, running everything from product to business to, all these congressional
the
hearings.
Face of the company, which is quite omnipresent.
So, people often tend to dunk on this guy, but I think he's done a phenomenal job in some sense, right?
Correct. No, I think some of the recent actions also. Facebook. I think at one level, Zuckerberg is a libertarian in the sense that he's also philosophically. I think he does believe that there should be a contestation of idea. There should be free speech and all that. And I think the political tide has turned against him in the sense that, I see like a lot of democratic establishment and ecosystem going after him in a very big way. I don't know, maybe they always never forgave him and hold him responsible for the 2016 election. Though I think he did everything to ensure that that doesn't repeat in 2020. I think like Facebook was almost, super... played the super censor in 2020 election cycle. Right. But I think that 2016 is, Facebook is seen as the epitome of all evil that enabled the orange man to come to power. And so they don't want to forgive him ever for that.
No, that's an albatross that will always hang, right? And it also, on a side note, it's crazy to me that people think that, someone saw a bunch of ads and then went and voted for one person, right? if only it was that easy. Right. All right. So that's a wrap from us. We have one more actually. So, quite a long weekly this time. So we've had a pretty controversial week in cricket, right? With Quinton de Kock, refusing to take the knee, and then there was allegedly some bad things that were said against Mohammad Shami as well. So Nirav, Prasanna, some quick comments.
So very quickly, I think India-Pakistan game, Mohammad Shami had an off day, but so did I think other 11 players. All Indian players didn't do as well as their potential, right? So pretty one-sided game, and I think been proven, but there are a lot of talks going on that these were a few anonymous handles, probably like elements either funded either by the ISI or some Pakistani propaganda team, which are trying to sow communal hate, right? I think Virat Kohli has come out with a very strong statement saying that no player should be criticized because of their religion. Every athlete, every sports person does have an off day. So did Rohit Sharma for getting a first ball duck, right? So you can't really blame it on that. And this kind of what has happened is the country has become very much polarized, at least on social media. And people are looking at it from their own lenses and like kind of aggravating the whole issue, which should be really a non-issue, right? The second thing, which is very interesting or another is ICC has taken the whole concept of, say, taking fight against racism, and players have been asked either to take the knee or have hand on their chest or like the raised fist, which was the symbol of black power. So as a fight against racism. Now, South Africa is a country with history of apartheid and a lot of racism, a lot of undercurrents that has been there. And in the first game versus Australia, all the white players, they stood up and put their fist up. But in, before the second game against West Indies, they were told that everybody has to take the knee or else. And Quinton de Kock refused, and he said that he would not be available to play the game. So this has got a lot of backlash, calling him white supremacist and like a lot of ugly words. But I think this has been like, maybe de Kock took a stupid decision because he feels aggrieved as not being the captain. He was earlier their T20 captain. He played with Themba Bavuma, who's a black player. This is just purely my speculation. And I think he took a decision in haste, just during the bus ride towards the stadium. Subsequently, he's given like a public statement. He said that he will take a knee. He's not a racist person. His stepmom is black. He's got mixed race half siblings. And he said that a real racist would have just taken the knee and shown it outward, but inside their actions would be different. So I think that's the whole thing. Again, this is another very big controversy. There have been complaints about racism from like ex-England cricketers like Devin Malcolm, and as well as like some Yorkshire cricketers, where like Indian or Pakistani origin cricketers have been treated fairly badly. So I think that needs to go. Racism has no place in sport. But these outward demonstrations probably don't do as much. We really need to see the change within all the organizing bodies and there. So I think, again, needless controversy. It's kind of because of social media, it has been amplified to a large extent.
Okay, I think like maybe last 2 minutes, Nirav is generally well spoken and not prone to anything very strident. But I think this entire Shami controversy is like, in my book, absolutely manufactured, orchestrated, and usual suspects fueling it, then the amplification. So it I don't know, it's a well executed psychops. In fact, I think Kohli faced more abuse for the New Zealand, for the fiasco against Pakistan. I don't know, I kind of follow a good micro, fairly large number of handles and all that. I think like Shami didn't even figure in as either a reason for the defeat I think if they had not scored 18 runs in that over, they would have won in the next over. It was just Pakistan was, that was a commanding performance by Pakistan that day. So I think they just wanted to, orchestrate this communal discord, and it's very easy to do that. And I think like part of it is also driven by the fact that there were a lot of celebrations in some pockets of India over the victory of Pakistan. See, let's be very honest that this is not a celebration of good cricket, or they like Babar Azam's technique, or they like Rizwan's emergence as a good batsman, or Shaheen Afridi's brilliant bowling or something like that. This is like unambiguous expression of support based on religious identity. Okay, so I think like since that emerged, this trolling of Shami was also pushed as a counter narrative, and it's absolutely silly. And honestly, I look forward to today's match where they don't have a good record against New Zealand in the ICC tournaments. I think in 2016, maybe Nirav as a cricket buff can correct me if I'm wrong. I think they had a thrashing by New Zealand. I think the match happened in Nagpur, and even without two principal bowlers in the New Zealand side, I think even Sodhi and the other left-arm spinner, Satner, I think they ran through the Indian side for 79. And my only concern is that this is my last point is that purely on cricketing merit, if the selection is made today, Shami is a very good test bowler. Okay, but if you really see his record in one day international or T20, I don't think so. It's as Nirav suggested, a one off day kind of a thing. He's a very he doesn't have that bag of tricks or that level of variation, which has become very critical in T20 actually. So he's like he has a lot of these hit me balls that he bowls at a good 137, 138 kmph, which you know, even in our own IPL, if you really see his record with Punjab Kings, I think he's been more often than not gone for a plenty, okay? But I would personally think Shardul Thakur, who has a much more interesting repertoire of tricks up his sleeves as a bowler, he has to probably play. But, you know, with all this controversy and Kohli also jumping into the bandwagon, I think like maybe Shami gets a game today. Let's see, you know, maybe it's...
I totally agree on the selection part. As in, Shami's IPL record as a Shardul Thakur is out there in the open, right? But yeah, as in... That aside, like what I wanted to say was, it was not that Shami deliberately played badly. Like,
No. Of course, he's done so well for India in test matches. He's a fantastic bowler. In fact, Shami himself has been trolled by people of his own faith for being progressive, right? Like I think he put out a nice pic of his daughter, and some participated in some Hindu festivity and all that stuff. And that's what I think. Shami's performance or lack of it was inconsequential to India's defeat against Pakistan. And I mean, there's no way that any fan would have, been furious about Shami, because, you know, once you have a 150 score with the kind of form that the Pakistan openers were showing, unless you had dismissed them very early, that match was a one-sided affair. And it got over in the first 10 overs itself, right?
Yeah, no, I think more people railed on Kohli than anyone else, right? And it was pretty obvious. It wasn't even close, I think. So, I think a couple of comments from Harsh Agarwal. He says, don't you think Shami episode can also be an information warfare trying to demean one community using anonymous bots? I think we've covered a bit of that.
I think that is what it is. Essentially, it's a psychops, you know, like, see, you always kind of game the scenarios that, you know, typically when an India-Pakistan match happens, and especially if India faces a defeat that way, obviously you will have angry fans and you play out all these identity things. These are all well thought out. Next day, almost on the cue, you had Bakadat writing a op-ed in Washington Post. And, you know, it's the same set of people. Surprisingly, if you really look at it, the handles that who might have said, none of them, mostly anonymous handles, nobody knows what happened. So it's completely farcical that it had to be reduced to this. I mean, you know, the identity was the last thing that needed to be discussed. It was a dismal performance by the Indian team. And I think the team selection itself, I really don't think so. I'll be very surprised if we proceed to the next round. Let me put it that way in this situation.
Right.
Is a virtual quarterfinal. Is a virtual quarterfinal, and then three warm-up games before the semis. India does win. That's probably true. But I think our team selection won't be the one which I like.
Unless Afghanistan kind of upsets New Zealand or something, and it can kind of turn it a bit. I don't know. But Afghanistan seems to be the real team, you know, like... It's tragic that you can't support them, because they will accuse you of supporting the Taliban regime, but they are they are a good team. I think the way they played against Pakistan, unfortunately.
They almost defeated Pakistan. Yeah. So yeah. Pakistan's closest game was versus Afghanistan. They beat India and New Zealand comprehensively.
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's also... I mean, people say anything on the internet, right? I mean, if I were to like pick and choose, I mean, I'll find anything and everything that, you know, reinforces certain beliefs or whatever you want, right? And for the captain of the Indian cricket team to sort of like pick that up, and not just him, I mean, I think few other players, and lend credibility to this after, I think, you know, even some of the, people with so-called liberal credentials also had said that, you know, hey, this is nonsense. I mean, I don't think this is, they had also called it a manufactured controversy.
Correct.
So for, it's, you know, the captain,
it, like, all this never happens. It is like very unusual. It seems like a well thought out PR, nothing else, very sinister. But, you know, of course, once you have the complete media narrative under your control, and I hope that Kohli is not cynically wading into this controversy because he's had a run of bad form. And hopefully, you know, I think he kind of focuses today, and he's too good a player to have been in this kind of form for this long, almost 2 years now. So hopefully, you know, he gets the focus back, and we see a good game.
I think every fan is hoping for the same thing, right? I mean, let's just play good cricket and move on, please. We have enough of politics and every other thing, right? Whether it's film or society, that even sport has to be invaded by this, right? All right. So that's a wrap from us. Before we wind up, a couple of interesting episodes coming up. I'll be talking to Ashley Rinsberg, who's just written a very nice book on basically the New York Times, reporting or inaccurate reporting over the last 100 years. He's done some meticulous research going back to, you know, how NYT has reported on.
The Nazi collaboration of New York Times is like,
It was crazy. Right. We don't. So that certainly surprised me. Right. And even the atom bomb also. Right. Plenty of things. Whether it's, you know, Russian communism, etc. There's been a very forget about inaccurate and like faulty reporting. Right. I mean, this is almost malfeasance. Right. I mean, it's to that. Right. So that should be an interesting episode. And also we are speaking to Aruna Sharma ji, who is a former bureaucrat and has written widely on a bunch of economic matters. And we're going to be talking to her about our path towards the $5 trillion economy. And that should be an interesting conversation for sure. So, all right, folks, thank you so much for joining. And thank you, Prasanna. Thank you, Nirav, for making this a very engaging weekly as well, as usual. So thank you, everyone. See you next week.